I think the two words that I would like to have described me was I kept the peace and I did all I could to promote human rights.
Hey y'all, this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey there, Jason Whiteley with you for this special episode of Y'allitics about the late President Jimmy Carter. No matter how you look at it, he really is the end of an era. A peanut farmer from Plains, Georgia, who rose to the world's most powerful position. Here's something I did not know about him until I started researching for the interview you're about to hear. Carter was the first U.S. president ever born in a hospital. He'll explain how that happened in just a moment. It is an interesting story. Politically, though, Jimmy Carter once described himself as, quote, conservative, moderate, liberal, and middle of the road, end quote. All of it. He was governor of Georgia in 1971, then elected president in 1976. Jimmy Carter was the country's first evangelical president, and he was the last Democrat to ever win in Texas. That's how long it's been. You probably know the highlights of the Carter administration. He was the first to broker peace in the Middle East. He also dealt with crippling inflation here at home. It soared to 14% on his watch. President Carter also negotiated the release of 66 Americans held hostage in Iran. Carter famously worked until the final hours of his administration to free those hostages. But Jimmy Carter might be best remembered for what he did after his presidency rather than his one term in the White House. We went to see him during one of his last visits to Texas. He was building a Habitat for Humanity homes, a full neighborhood actually, in the Oak Cliff part of Dallas. It was 2014. Carter had just turned 90 years old. The former president sat down his toolbox, pulled up a chair, and looked back at his life, his legacy, and politics with us. Mr. President, thanks for sitting down with us and laying down the hammer and drill for a moment.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. Get a little rest.
I think I overdressed for this also. Everyone else is a lot more casual here. Tell me about this. How many houses have you helped build since the mid-80s when you joined Habitat?
3,800 is what the Habitat folks have tabulated. The biggest event was in the Philippines. We built 296 houses in 5 days, but we had 14,000 volunteers with us. So that's the largest, but usually we do try to do at least 100 a year. And this, I think we're doing 110 this year in Dallas and Fort Worth combined.
And I understand your wife won't let you on the roof anymore.
Oh, that's when she's here, I don't get on the roof.
When she's not here?
Well, I do what I want to.
Yeah, I read that you equate the feeling of handing over keys to a new homeowner as the exultation that you got when you asked your wife to marry you, took the oath of office and things like that. Was that accurate?
Well, I wouldn't say it was exciting, but it's more emotional. You know, I don't think I've ever handed over the keys to the house and given the, you know, new homeowners a Bible that I always sign without the homeowners shedding tears. And I ordinarily join them with a few teardrops running down my cheeks. It is an emotional thing to see a family that has never had a decent home in their life get a house that they own. And they have already put in 500 hours of work on the house by the time they take ownership. And they have to pay full price for the house. But the Bible says you don't charge interest to a poor person, so we don't charge any interest in the United States at all. Zero interest. So you take the price of the house, these are about $80,000, and divide that into 240 months in 20 years, and you see that the monthly payments are lower than they've been paying for sometimes subhuman rental property. So it's a very wonderful feeling to see that happen.
This is the 31st year. You're building more than 100 homes here in Dallas-Fort Worth. But I read you never intended this to be a regular event when you started.
No, we didn't. We just went to New York the first year in 1984 to help out some college students who were dealing with a six-story building. You could stand on the second floor and see the sky through the roof. It was a dilapidated old building. And we had to go back there 2 years. And then after that, the next year we went to Chicago. The next year we went to Philadelphia and Atlanta combined. And we've been going ever since. We have some people with us. In fact, our supervisor on this building has been with us 29 years now.
Wow.
So it's a wonderful, it's kind of a labor of love.
How long do you think you'll do this?
Well, I think till I'm physically and mentally, as long as I'm physically and mentally able. But I think that my vigor now compared to when I was only 85 years old is probably down about 10%. I'm 90 this year.
I do want to talk to you about that in just a moment here too. You've revisited other Habitat homes over the years and said you've never seen them dilapidated at all. You've never seen graffiti on homes at all.
That's true. I never saw a broken window that was not fixed. I never saw graffiti on a building. I've never seen a lawn that wasn't mowed. When the people get their own house, they're just extraordinarily proud of it. And sometimes we go into an area and we build a few Habitat houses, say 100 houses in a big neighborhood. And then the other homeowners see the Habitat owners taking care of their house. So it kind of lifts up the level of a personal care among people that own their own houses. But if you see a government housing project, a rental property nearby, it might be dilapidated. But when people own their own house for the first time and they're 30 or 40 years old, when they get their first house, I guarantee you they will take perfect care of it.
You talked about the emotion of handing over the keys to a homeowner.
Yes.
At the end of the day, after 31 years, what kind of satisfaction do you get out of this when you put your head on the pillow at night?
Well, I feel the same way I used to feel when I plowed a mule from daybreak till sundown. And you look back and you see I've done all I possibly could as a human being. And I've helped somebody else as well. So I think that's about all a human being can do. It's just do your best and at the same time help somebody else.
Are you surprised that other world leaders haven't followed your lead over the years?
Well, a lot of them have temporarily, as long as the television cameras are there. In fact, the house we built in the Philippines, we had four presidents work on it. I and the incumbent president and two former presidents of the Philippines came out and worked for about 30 minutes each. And then and the woman that moved into that house, it was only 30 square meters or 300 square feet. She and her three daughters had been sleeping in an abandoned septic tank. And they would crawl in that septic tank, not much bigger than a dining room table, and cover up the top with plastic every night, and that's how they've been sleeping. So you can imagine how they felt to move into a house that was 300 square feet, which is about the size of an average den in the United States.
How did you guys pick Dallas-Fort Worth, the need here? How does this equate to other places in the country?
Every time we go to somebody, to some place, I have to approve it. The Habitat people recommended two or three locations, and I chose the one I wanted. As a matter of fact, that's a privilege that I still have. We have to go to an area that is well prepared for us. We've got 5,000 volunteers working on homes this year in Dallas and Fort Worth. And also we were informed and we found it to be true that there's a remarkable degree of harmony and teamwork between Dallas and Fort Worth. Although I'm sure they are competitive in other areas, on the two Habitat organizations were working with perfect harmony. And also that both of the city governments had raised enough money so that the cost of this house now will be about $20,000 less than it actually cost Habitat, because the difference has been raised. So the house is actually costing Habitat about $100,000, and the homeowner will only have to pay $80,000 because the other $20,000 was raised by people who were donors in Dallas and Fort Worth.
What was the need greater here, sir, than other places you saw nationwide?
Well, that's hard to judge. Even if some other community has a greater need and they don't have the infrastructure to handle all the enormous logistical problem, then we just have to bypass those other places. But now they are done by some of the 4,000 Habitat affiliates or organizations in the United States. But when Rosa and I go, instead of just being two workers, we've got 5,000 workers.
Right.
So that's a problem that we have, a challenge that we need.
You just celebrated a big milestone birthday this month. Happy birthday to you on that.
Thank you.
I read that you're the first elected president born in a hospital.
I was. My mother was a registered nurse in a little town of Plains. We had 500 people living in Plains at that time. Now we've grown to 630. And my mother was a registered nurse. She was the operating room assistant to the doctor. And he wanted to get her back in the operating room as quickly as he could. And he had an empty room right across the hall from the operating room. So my mother had a baby in the hospital. And even wealthy people in those days didn't do that. An obstetrician came to the house. Or if you were poorer, then you had a midwife come. So So all the other rich, you know, families at Rockefellers and all those, they had their babies born in their own home and not go to hospital. But I was the first one that was born in the hospital.
90 years old. What do you think your legacy should be? More political, more humanitarian? What?
Well, I think both combined. I think the two words that I would like to have described me was I kept the peace and I did all I could to promote human rights. And we look on human rights, particularly at Habitat, as not just freedom of speech and freedom of the press and you know, trial by jury, but also the right to have a home that's decent, and the right to have food to eat, and the right to have a modicum of education, and a little bit of health care. Those are basic human rights that quite often an American doesn't think about as a human right. We think about, you know, political freedom. But for people who are desperately poor, the first thing they want is a decent home in which they and their children can live, and rather than living under a bridge or, you know, out on the street. So I think Habitat's taking care of maybe the number one basic human right on earth.
That's your legacy. How do you personally, though, want to be remembered? Keeping the peace, or?
Yeah, keeping the peace. You know, when, you know, we've been at war almost constantly since the Second World War. If you look at it, I think we've been at war with about 35 different countries now. And when I was in the White House, you know, fortunately, and my commitment, we never fired a bullet, we never dropped a bomb, we never launched a missile while I was in the White House.
Any regrets? I'm sorry, sir.
So that was good luck, and also my determination to keep the peace.
Any regrets over the years? Now you're 90, look back when you're sitting up there drilling in a fence post. You ever look back and wish you'd done something different?
Well, not much. You know, I've had a glorious and very lucky life. Rose and I were both still in very good health. We take a lot of exercise, we eat the right food, we married the right people, I think, and that helps a lot. So we've been lucky in not being afflicted with an uncontrollable or unpredictable or preventable disease. You know, a lot of people have a heart attack, a lot of people have cancer, and they didn't do anything wrong. We've so far been lucky.
You told another reporter you don't eat a lot of red meat. How's that gonna go over in Texas?
Well, you know, in Texas we eat a lot of red meat, and we don't buy red meat in the stores, but I'm a hunter, and we eat a good bit of venison. We eat a lot of ducks and geese and quail. I shoot quail, hunt doves, but my main hunting commitment is wild turkey hunting. So I go out on my own farms and kill two wild turkeys every year, one for Thanksgiving, one for Christmas. So we eat meat, but we don't have to buy meat.
Do you hunt quite a bit, or is it just in the fall?
Well, the spring, we only have a spring turkey season in Georgia from the middle of March to the middle of May, just about 60 days. And that's when I do most of my hunting when I'm home. But we have programs in 80 countries, the Carter Center does. We only work on Habitat 1 week a year, 80, you know, 51 weeks a year we're working on Carter Center programs. But when I'm home in the morning, I'm out in my own farms hunting turkeys.
I do want to switch in the last few minutes here. We're going to cut you out early here, but I do want to switch to a few political topics, if you don't mind.
Fine.
You're the first evangelical president, but you support gay marriage. And a lot of conservative Christians might look at that and say, well, the Bible says it's an abomination. How do you reconcile that personally within your own faith?
Well, I kind of draw what I consider to be the right line. I don't think that the government ought ever to have the right to tell a church to marry people if the church doesn't want to. I'm a Baptist, and the congregation of our church will decide whether we have a man or a woman as pastor and whether we'll marry gay people or not. And if my church votes not to marry gay people, we wouldn't do it, and I wouldn't want them to. But I think that all people ought to have an equal right. And people that happen to be gay, I don't think it's a preventable or caused by anything. I think they ought to have equal rights to marry.
And the Supreme Court said it wouldn't hear the issue. Do you think that marriage licenses will ever be issued nationwide, or just states will handle this separately?
I'm kind of inclined to let the states decide individually. And now, as you see, more and more states are deciding on gay marriages every year. But if Texas doesn't want to have gay marriages, then I think that's a right for Texas people to decide.
Couple last things here. You said it's a mistake to bomb Syria because there's no good ground intelligence.
That's correct.
But should the U.S. have gotten involved, you think, in some form after the chemical weapons were used and 200,000 people have died?
Well, you know, the 200,000 people have been died on both sides. They're not all killed by the government. But anyway, I think that in retrospect, you know, I'm not privy to the secret information, and I'm not involved in the decision, but in retrospect, I think we should have started earlier in trying to deal with ISIS in Syria. And we should have helped the moderate Muslims then, opponents to Assad, at the early stage. Now they've just about all left. The Carter Center is actively involved in Syria every day. We work in Syria still. And it's almost impossible to find any moderate Muslims who are actually in Syria fighting. Most of the ones we find, we have to go to Turkey to find them, or go to Paris or London to find them. And I don't see any adequate ground troops in Syria to do one of two things. One is to direct our aerial bombing and our drone strikes and missile strikes. Somebody needs to tell us where to put those missiles when they strike. And if nobody is there that with whom we can communicate and depend on, then we are just striking indiscriminately. And in the cities that are still in contest, they're filled with civilians still. And if we make a few strikes and kill a lot of civilians, then we're going to turn the people against us that we really need to support us when and if we can drive ISIS out. I think, though, on the other hand, in Iraq, I think we have an adequate degree of ground strength to do those two things, particularly with the U.S. troops there, to give us ground direction for our missile strikes, and also maybe with the courage and others to follow up if and when we hurt ISIS enough to make them vulnerable.
Two last questions for you, too. Turkey said that it didn't think airstrikes alone could defeat ISIS. Do you see a point where we should be sending ground troops to fight these?
No, I don't think U.S. ground troops are there. I think that Erdogan in Turkey is wrong. I think he ought to let the Turkish ground troops be helping us. But, you know, he's demanded something that I'm sure President Obama is considering, and that is a no-fly zone over that area. And as long as the United States planes are going in and bombing, and a few other Arab countries are doing the same thing, then that's an adequate response to Erdogan's request for no-fly zone, because Assad's not going to send his planes in over those areas where the United States and others are bombing. So I think that's something that can be negotiated at the foreign minister level.
Last question here for you, too. You have famously helped eradicate the guinea worm around the world. How do you feel about the president's response to Ebola in West Africa? And what should the case here in Dallas, do you think, teach this country?
Well, first of all, to answer your first question, I think President Obama reacted quite well after the director of CDC went over to West Africa and came back and gave an accurate description of what was going on. I think everybody underestimated it to begin with. We've had Ebola outbreaks, as you know, since the 1960s, and we've always corrected it. This was much more serious than anybody thought. But I think once that President Obama was informed accurately about the situation there by CDC, he reacted quite well. He tried to launch a worldwide effort to raise funds, and he sent 3,000 troops in originally, and I think now he's expanded that to 4,000. So I think he's done a good job since then. But I think the United Nations and the United States underestimated the problem to begin with.
Should the case here in Dallas teach this country anything? Because we never expected it to come inside our borders.
I really believe that the Centers for Disease Control has full control and full knowledge about the disease now. And I don't believe that the people in Dallas or Texas or anywhere else in the United States needs to be worrying about getting Ebola. There might be one or two more cases, you know, out of 350 million people or whatever it is, but I don't think anybody needs to panic. They need not keep the children out of school or do drastic things like that.
Mr. President, it's good to see you, and keep up the good work, and happy birthday to you.
Thank you very much, Jason. I enjoyed being with you.
We did make some news there at the time in 2014 with that interview. If you were listening closely, you might have got it. Sure, we talked about Ebola and Syria, some things that are kind of dated. But did you hear President Carter say that he thought that states should decide gay marriage? This conversation with me and President Carter happened before the Obergefell decision at the U.S. Supreme Court, which, you know, granted gay marriage rights nationwide. Well, what was interesting, though, I thought, is that Carter said he thought that states should decide gay marriage because the Supreme Court ended up saying the same thing about abortion rights last year. And that statement by Carter, a Democrat who served as president of the United States, it just shows the complexity of Carter. He's the first evangelical president. It reinforces that time that he said that he was conservative and liberal and middle of the road, all wrapped up in one, when he was running for governor of Georgia back in the early 1970s. He was a president, he was a peacemaker, he was a humanitarian, he was the last Democrat to win Texas. And I think more than anything, Carter really was someone who never forgot where he came from. Hope you found that conversation with President Carter interesting. We always appreciate you listening to Yolitics, to downloading it. Tell your friends about our podcast as well.